Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories at the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com. You can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana Cuba. We'll begin with France 24. Anti-immigrant riots broke out in more than a dozen cities in the UK, with attacks on refugee housing, mosques, and Muslims. It began after the brutal murder of 3 girls by a young man falsely identified on social media as an illegal immigrant. He was born in England. A very large police response could not stop the growth of the mayhem, which lasted into nights and 5 days later is continuing. There have been large protests against the anti-immigrant rioters, and over 500 people have been arrested. First, a short report on the riots. Then Elizabeth Poole, a professor of media at Keele University, talks about the role of social media spreading disinformation. France 24.
Windows of this hotel in Rotherham were smashed as anti-immigrant protesters threw stones at the building that has been used to house asylum seekers. They also started fires and clashed with police. Violent demonstrations involving anti-immigration groups have broken out in towns and cities across Britain in what has become the worst rioting in the country for over a decade. Residents here in Blackpool have been left shaken.
I heard several people got badly injured and hurt. One of my friends who was out there saw someone getting pushed over and hitting their head hard, getting carried to an ambulance.
Attacking your hometowns, affecting your own businesses and things like that, it's not right.
The unrest comes after a stabbing in Southport that killed 3 young girls on Monday. False information about the suspect's background quickly spread online, fueling anti-Muslim and anti-immigration demonstrations, even after police confirmed the suspect was born in Britain. The violence has prompted hundreds of mosques to step up security. It's a first test for newly elected Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who has promised a firm response.
I think there needs to be the full force of the law, and I think it needs to be swift. What happened in 2011 was that we were able to see individuals who took part in violence, arrested, charged, remanded and convicted very swiftly. Standing arrangements are in place for that, and we will do whatever it takes to ensure that the message is absolutely clear that if you're taking part in this violence, you will regret it and you'll be brought to justice as quickly as possible.
Dozens of arrests have been made, and in Sunderland, where violence hit a peak on Friday, several officers had to be hospitalised.
We can now bring in Elizabeth Poole, Professor of Media and Communications at Keele University. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme today. It seems that this unrest in the UK has gotten out of control because of the lack of policing on social media, where disinformation seems to spread so quickly. How dangerous is this, in your opinion?
Well, it's a complex issue. So obviously these things are not caused by social media, but sometimes social media facilitates and when these things go viral, they get more momentum and therefore more people join in and this creates a kind of snowballing effect. So, so we should understand that these issues are societal problems, but they become more viral. Social media is a facilitator of those kind of like expressions of hate and polarisation in society.
And is this anti-immigrant rhetoric we're seeing online focused towards the Muslim community in particular?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric in general, but the Muslim community has been singled out as in particular four far-right groups as being a kind of like cultural threat to the UK. So that has been an ongoing theme of their kind of narratives for quite some time now.
I know the new government has been in power just for a couple of weeks, so not enough time, but clearly there seems to be a problem of Islamophobia. So how do you go about addressing this?
Well, I think one of the problems is that not many people mention Islamophobia. It's quite taboo, really. So that's one of the issues, is that a lot of people have talked about far-right thuggery and anti-immigration rhetoric, but not really about Islamophobia. Mm. So that's the first thing that needs to be done, really, is to think, you know, this is a problem and it needs to be dealt with. So recognising that and speaking its name is important.
And what about the rhetoric which we have witnessed over the past few years from political figures in the United Kingdom, like Nigel Farage, like Suella Braverman, who used to talk about an invasion of migrants coming in? That in itself is dangerous, isn't it? And has sort of fanned the flames of what we're seeing today.
Yeah, so this is where it starts, isn't it? It's politicians, it's senior figures that spread this rhetoric. It's also the British right-wing press. You know, we've had years and years of anti-Islam, anti-immigration narratives, themes, issues coming up in the press, and all this is circulated and it kind of makes it normalised. So, you know, it's what Baroness Saeed Varsi called the dinner party test, where she said that it's become so normalised that people would be willing to talk about Muslims in such a way over a dinner party and not feel ashamed like they would other minority groups. So, yeah, it's kind of been normalised.
And what about the role of Elon Musk in all of this? Because, of course, a lot of this disinformation is spread on X, formerly Twitter, which he himself owns. And these riots are something he's been actively talking about on his social media platform.
Yeah, so obviously this contributes to kind of stoking and keeping the narrative going, I suppose. And really, that's kind of like the business model, isn't it, of some of these companies that, you know, commercially, this kind of inflammatory, sensationalist material keeps them going. It's their oxygen. So for him to be involved himself is financially productive for him. But, yeah, a lot of the research we've done has shown that before he acquired the platform, that actually the moderation standards were quite strict, and there had been quite a clampdown on this kind of like anti-Muslim rhetoric, and there was a lot of supportive counter-narratives against it on Twitter. But more recently, because of the opening up of the platform and the reduction of moderation standards, research has shown that there's been a rise of hate speech on that platform again.
Because there is this downside with social media platforms like X, but it can also be used for good in terms of getting the Muslim community in the UK to band together.
Yeah, so the research that we've done shows that there's significant solidarity, and activists use X and other social media platforms to show allyship, really, with communities that are marginalised. But also these platforms give those communities a voice where perhaps in the past they might not have had that voice in mainstream media. So the research that we've shown shows significant Muslim voices on X and other platforms that then get significant solidarity from allies across the world. And that creates these kind of counter narratives and counter publics that contest this kind of negative discourse, which we're seeing now, actually. And you can see, you know, there's this kind of like countering by these anti-racist groups that's playing out now. So, you know, hopefully that will seize the momentum and things will take a different turn.
Elizabeth, you're a professor of media and communications. I want to know, how are newspapers in the country covering these riots?
Well, I've been following some of the right-wing press representation. And again, you do see this kind of like double standards narrative, where there's this idea that the police are policing far right groups much more than kind of like Muslim groups and anti-racist groups that have come out to kind of protect mosques. So there's this kind of idea, which has also been circulated on social media, this two-tier Kenya, that there's two-tier policing. And also there's a lot more focus on, you know, the problems of like the Muslim Defence League and framing Muslims as kind of like thugs rather than the far right.
Elizabeth Poole, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
That report and interview were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Deutsche Welle put together a remarkable 38-minute report called Eyewitness Testimonies, What Doctors Saw in Gaza. I've taken 7 minutes of these testimonies to air, but I highly recommend that you visit DW News on YouTube and watch the entire report. It is incredibly informative and moving, with international doctors who have volunteered time trying to provide medical assistance to injured Gazans while watching tens of thousands also die from diseases that could have been easily saved with basic medications and hospital beds. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
I've been in Jordan for the Zaatari refugee camp for Syrian refugees. I was in Greece, Thessaloniki, next to the Hungarian border when there were refugees on the ground there. I've been in Haiti, I've been in Ghana, I've been with Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh.
I had been to northern Syria after the earthquake, Turkey after the earthquake. I've been to Greece during the refugee crisis, to Jordan.
I started in Pakistan. I have worked more than 2 years in Afghanistan, Nigeria. I was in South Sudan.
I worked in the Gaza in the previous war. I work in the Syria and I work in Lebanon.
I've been in Syria, I've been in Yemen, I've been in Iraq and in South Lebanon.
All of those trips are nothing compared to this trip.
I have never seen this kind of crisis in my life.
It's different here.
But I've never been in a genocidal war where the aim is to wipe out everything, where the aim is to take out the health system as a central part of the military strategy.
Gaza is on another level, and it's all because everything is working against the people and you just see it.
So I remember once looking out of the window and seeing a whole neighborhood go up in flames as the Israelis dropped what we now know are 2,000-pound bombs on a neighborhood. The whole neighborhood goes up in flames, and then there's a dust bowl. And then once the dust bowl settles, there's nothing left of that neighborhood. And so it's not like a building was targeted. The whole neighborhood disappeared. When they bombed the water desalination plants, when they bomb the sewage pumping plants, you could see that there were two parallel targets. One was this massive elimination and annihilation of human life. And the other was the infrastructure, the investment in the destruction of infrastructure that they hoped would then create a genocidal killing machine of diseases and of famine.
There was no stretchers, there was no linens, there was no gauze, very, very small amounts of gauze available for wound care, blood products, transfusions, infusions of IV fluids, all those things were in extremely short supply. And that's because there's been a very conscious and structural effort not to allow any medical supplies in, which shocks people when they hear it and they think, I've already talked to people who almost don't believe me, and I tell them, this isn't me telling you what I heard on the news. This is me telling you what I had with me when I tried to go in to Gaza. I had, 5-6 suitcases full of medical supplies that I kind of prepared like I do on every mission I've ever gone on. Medicines, antibiotics, all those things. And I was denied every one of those bags from entering.
And even you can carry one bag with you that's less than 23 kilograms. I mean, but when we were entering through Rafah in Egypt, myself and four other physicians brought in 23 bags of medical supplies. And that's because we know that the trucks are stalled at the borders. We know that the trucks are not able to get in with medical supplies, with infant formula.
Everything refrigerated is gone. And when you talk about medication, you think about all the medications, including insulin for diabetes, is not viable anymore, right? So every single patient with type 1 diabetes that is 100% dependent upon insulin, they're dying. There's nothing we can do for them. I would say more. We saw more amputations from the complexity of end-stage diabetes than we did from the bomb blasts. And we saw more bomb blast amputations than I ever wanted to see in my entire life. They're choked off from the rest of the world.
That again, if there is a ceasefire tomorrow and you open the borders totally and you allow all of the possible medical supplies and aid and food and water in, that there will still be thousands of people that will die because it's just too little, too late. And we know that that's how the conditions have been set. And this has been well established. This is not speculation and this is not opinion of physicians. This has been well established by John Hopkins School of Public Health, the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. The Lancet had recently published an article thinking that the death toll is much higher and that this is what could happen. And the way that people can understand this is we always talk about in COVID, if we ran out of ventilators and supplies, how many people would die who would have otherwise survived? That number is astronomically high in Gaza. And it's precisely because of the cruelty of the way that the war has been prosecuted. This is where you see the horrifying cruelty that's taking place. It's when you've stopped bombing them and you've stopped having troops on the ground and people are still dying in large numbers. It's not just about the building that gets bombed and the people that die in the bombing. It's the fact that where thousands of people were sheltering, they don't shelter there anymore. And now they have to go to an even more crowded place. So the risk of disease will spread there. And then you hear that an area where there was water available, like in Rafah 2 days ago, the Israeli army destroyed a water infrastructure plant there. You think, okay, it's destroyed, there's damage to the building, but the ripple effect, it's so deep and it's gonna cause so many problems that that's something that I think needs more attention. Because, that's one thing to die in an airstrike. It's one thing to be a victim of trauma, but it's another thing to starve to death. It's another thing to die from a disease that has a medicine that all you need is a clean bed and enough supplies in a hospital to survive. But to die from that and to die slowly and painfully from that, I mean, that's what's going to happen in Gaza. And that's what's happening already in Gaza.
This whole narrative that the Israelis created to try to justify the targeting of the health system, you know, from the whole idea that Shifa has all of these underground bunkers and none of them were found, these command and control centers, all of this, had it been true, one, we would have been, you as journalists would have been taken on tours underneath Shifa Hospital in these bunkers.
If you can make excuses for kids being killed, if you can somehow come up with an excuse and be like, well, you know, there were these people that were hiding in the area, or, you know, it's the in 2006, the people of Gaza voted this way, then there's one of two things. I mean, either you don't view them as human beings, or you think that it's that you're going to somehow arrive at a solution by doing this. And I think both are incredibly wrong. You will never, you know, achieve any sort of solution just by, you know, killing as many kids that have been killed or as many innocent people that have been killed. And the second part of this is, yes, if you don't think that they are kids like your kids, if you don't view a young girl like somebody who you're related to, then you can easily come up with these excuses. But that's what I would challenge people to. I challenge them to just be able to look at Palestinians and see themselves in the Palestinians, see your own family, see your own life story. And if you can do that, I guarantee you'll come up with a different answer.
That excerpted report was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. I again highly recommend that you visit their website and watch the full report called Eyewitness Testimonials, What Doctors Saw in Gaza. On to NHK Japan. The U.S. and most G7 nations are staying away from the annual memorial at Nagasaki because Israel was not invited. A court in Thailand ordered that the largest pro-democracy political party be disbanded. China has launched 100 satellites for global internet access like Elon Musk's Starlink. NHK Japan.
The Japanese city of Nagasaki marks 79 years since the U.S. atomic bombing on Friday. Many ambassadors attend the annual peace ceremony there, but this year that'll not include top envoys from the United States and most G7 nations. Their decision to skip the ceremony follows the city's announcement it will not invite Israel's ambassador, citing concerns about possible disruption. The U.S. Embassy says Ambassador Rahm Emanuel sent a letter to Nagasaki's mayor earlier this week in which he described the city's move as political. That's a sentiment shared by British Ambassador Julia Longbottom, who will not be attending as well. The British Embassy says Israel could be seen as being treated like Russia and Belarus, which are the only other countries that have not been invited to this year's ceremony. The French, German, Italian, and Canadian embassies have also told NHK their ambassadors will not attend due to Israel's exclusion. A court in Thailand has ordered the largest pro-democracy opposition party to disband. The Move Forward party took the most seats in last year's general election and remains popular, so the order could trigger a backlash from supporters. The Constitutional Court ruled the party's campaign pledge to amend the Royal Defamation Law had the intention to undermine the monarchy and could lead to the overthrow of the democratic regime headed by the king. The law makes it illegal to insult the royal family. The court also barred Pita Limcharonlat and other party leaders from any political activities for 10 years.
It's like the court doesn't see the importance of the party representing the people they work for. It's like they don't see the importance of the people's voice.
I don't think the party will fade from people's minds. It may be dissolved, but will remain in our hearts.
The Move Forward party won over young voters with its promise to amend the Royal Defamation Law and end the military's influence in politics. But it was locked out of the coalition government and became an opposition party. In January, the Constitutional Court ruled the party's bid to amend the law was unconstitutional. Then in March, the Election Commission asked the court to disband the Move Forward party. China has launched a batch of satellites aimed at creating a global internet network it hopes will rival Elon Musk's Starlink. Chinese state media said the launch took place Tuesday at Taiyuan Satellite Launch Center in Shanxi Province. It's reportedly the first phase of a constellation that'll provide users around the world with reliable internet. The state-run enterprise behind the project said it plans to send more than 10,000 satellites into space by the year 2030. It reportedly aims to create its own version of the Starlink network provided by U.S. company SpaceX, which is set to play a role in the use of drones and other warfare communications.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they are heard at 10 p.m. at 11735. Or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp and most podcast sites. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, there's a link for online support available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please keep it up. We'll conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. An update on the re-election of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela and the U.S.-led attempts to prevent his victory. At the United Nations, 100 countries and 23 organizations have backed Cuba, affirming that it does not belong on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Radio Havana, Cuba.
I saw your appearance before the press on Telesur, and I congratulate you again, Brother Nicolás Maduro. This declared Miguel Díaz-Canel first secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Cuba. The Cuban head of state assured that the U.S. recognition of the losing candidate of the elections of last July 28th is another proof of who is pulling the strings of the conspiracy against the Bolivarian Revolution. Maduro denounced in a press conference Friday that the United States is at the forefront of the attempted coup against him. According to the Venezuelan president, he activated the mechanism before the Supreme Court of Justice, the TSJ, to clarify all the lies on which they intend to mount a cyber coup against the people and against democracy. Quote, the United States of America has put itself at the forefront of this coup d'etat with its usual allies. He added that Venezuela had suffered a brutal attack, a cyber attack on its entire communication system, and today they attacked the Patria system. The National Electoral Council ratified Nicolas Maduro as president of Venezuela on Friday after reaching 51.95% of the votes after counting 96.87% of the transmission of the minutes. The number of voters counted was 12,386,669, representing a participation rate of 59.97 percentage points. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez on Monday thanked 23 international and regional organizations for their statement against the island's inclusion in the unilateral list of states sponsoring terrorism. On the social network X, the Minister of Foreign Affairs expressed his gratitude for the complaints made against the measure that negatively impacts the Cuban people. Recently, the Foreign Ministry reported that more than 100 countries demanded the exclusion of Cuba from the list of alleged countries sponsoring terrorism, and this was drawn up by the United States government. Through a declaration, the nations that signed the document addressed to the Human Rights Council pointed out that the list, quote, goes against the fundamental principles and the imperative norms of international law, including international solidarity, unquote. They stressed that the inclusion of the Caribbean nation, quote, causes extraordinary negative consequences for the Cuban economy due to its intimidating effect and the obstacle to economic and financial operations of third parties with Cuba for fear of being fined. It hinders the country's ability to access food, medicine, fuel, medical equipment and other basic goods that impacts the realization of economic, social and cultural rights, the statement added.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, though there are no podcasts. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.